Hello and welcome to a new conversation about software engineering. This is Sebald Wolf from InnoQ. Today on the CASE podcast, we will talk about Spring Data, Spring Data REST, and Spring HTOS. My guest is Oliver Gierke. Oliver is the lead of the Spring Data project at Pivotal, formerly known as SpringSource, and he's also a member of the JPA 2.1 expert group. He's been developing enterprise applications and open source projects for over 8 years now, and his focus is centered around software architecture, Spring, REST, and persistence. He is a regular speaker at German and international conferences, and also he wrote a lot of technology articles as well as the first book on Spring Data. Welcome to the show, Oliver.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining in. So what we are going to talk about today are some parts of the Spring ecosystem. So maybe we should start by talking about Spring in general. So what is the Spring framework?
The Spring framework is an open source application framework for JVM-based languages, mostly Java, of course. And it's probably the mostly used application framework in the ecosystem. It's used in enterprise applications, but also in smaller applications. It integrates with a lot of Java EE standards, but naturally extends it to some other areas that are not necessarily covered by the standards yet, and thus acts as a fundamental application framework, taking care of things like transactions, security, the way you structure your application, and all these things.
Okay, great. So who is behind Spring?
It's an open source project after all, but there's a company called Pivotal, the company I work for, that employs most of the engineers behind the framework, the core framework, and the ecosystem projects. However, especially since our move to GitHub as our primary source tracker, there's been a lot of contributions from outside that the Pivotal space, and it's continuously growing, and the integration with the community is still a great source of innovation and a great driver for us. So it's the company aspect, people being paid for writing the software, but also integrating casual contributors.
Okay. I heard about Spring Boot, and that seems to be one of the latest bigger improvements in the Spring frame ecosystem. So what is it?
So the Spring framework is a very configurable framework, so it lays a lot of foundations for, as I mentioned, things like transactions and security. But that also means that users of the framework, application developers, have to make their own decisions about like which persistence provider they use, which templating engine they use for their web views in case they're writing a web application. And Spring Boot takes an opinionated approach on exactly that on top of the Spring framework. So it basically defaults a couple of decisions for you that you can undo if you know what you're doing, basically. But it gives you a more packaged, out-of-the-box experience and gets you started easily with the framework itself, and then also integrates with a lot of the ecosystem projects that we have out there. Things like Spring Batch, Spring Integration, so the workload-specific projects that we have. There is even extensions on top of Spring Boot nowadays with Spring Cloud, which sort of covers the microservices/cloud-native application space. It's basically like, think of it as a Pivotal consultant, Spring consultant, baked into code and helping you to start with decent decisions about technology choices, configuration approaches, also the aspect of like getting your app to production.
Okay, cool. So as you just mentioned, nowadays it's not just about the Spring framework itself, but it's a whole ecosystem with Spring Boot and all the other projects that you mentioned. And actually what we are going to focus today is one part of the Spring ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So we are going to talk about Spring Data. So obviously you're the project lead. So can you say a few words about what that project actually provides?
Of course. The project started like almost 10 years ago, I think. At least some of the predecessors of it started back then already. It's an extension of the already existing data access support that you get from the core Spring framework. The core framework takes care of like things like raw JDBC access, improving that. It also helps you with like setting up JPA, which is the Java Persistence API, the object mapping, object relational mapping standard we have in Java EE. It does that for you or gives you guidance with that. But it turned out that on the one side there was, or we felt the need to raise the abstraction level slightly with the relational space. And also back in the days, and it was around 2010 then, we started looking into supporting NoSQL data stores, which especially back then were not really well supported in the Java space. So interestingly, the Neo4j guys, the Neo4j graph database, started to work with Rod Johnson back in the days on Neo4j template, similar to the JDBC template, which is a helper class to ease data access with JDBC and in that case then Neo4j.
Yeah, so maybe we should mention Rod with a few words because he is one of the original founders of the Spring Framework itself.
Right.
And wrote the original book that started the whole Spring idea.
Exactly. Emil and Rod basically put their hands together and wrote something similar to the JDBC support for a graph database, which was kind of the starter. Later on, we basically pulled other things together, like the as I'm probably going to speak about the repository support in JPA and what have you. So
can you say a few words about why you would provide such an abstraction layer? I mean, obviously there is JDBC, so JDBC is the usual API that you would use to access databases in Java. Why would you add an API on top of that?
On JDBC, you mean?
Yeah, or generally speaking. I mean, also Neo4j, I assume, has sort of a native API. So you're adding those abstraction layers on top of them, and I wonder why you do that.
There's like two aspects to that. I'd like to like sort of separate the relational side of things from the NoSQL side of things, because on the NoSQL side we also cover different problems. But let's start with the JPA side, right? We already have an standardized API for object relational mapping. So there's already APIs to map the data store onto objects.
Right.
And we could use the entity manager that's a concept from JPA, to actually access the objects. But
JPA is the Java Persistence API standardized as part of the Java official Java EE standard.
Java EE standard, right. Exactly. So on the idea we started in that area is that usually your applications then implement some kind of data access objects, or if you're into the DDD space, domain-driven design, a bit more, then you think of a collection of entities or aggregates in terms of a repository. And what we originally started on is a mechanism, a programming model for those repositories, an interface-based programming model, so that you can get rid of most of the implementation code, because we sort of use mechanisms that might be familiar from frameworks like Grails or Rails even, where you can just like declare a method in your repository interface and the framework will sort out the query to be executed for that method.
So you just declare a method like find by name and then automatically the correct query would be.
Exactly. That'd be the most simple case. There's of course like means to back those methods with more complex queries, because your application usually has a more complex querying requirements.
Right.
But it gives us a decent layer of abstraction to actually sort of, I hate to use the word hide, but to basically unify the way you work with the data access API that then translates nicely into the NoSQL space that you mentioned. And there is, of course, the NoSQL space is much more diverse than the relational space, where you, of course, have different database providers, but still they all speak SQL, right? More or less. And in the JPA providers usually already abstract a lot of the differences between the databases, for better or for worse. That you can have different opinions on that. But the NoSQL space, just by the fact that it like summarizes the entire space by something that the technologies are not, right? NoSQL basically results in the fact that you have very, very different and diverse database technologies to deal with. And the question comes up, how do you actually ease the developer's task to navigate through that space or implement an application on top of those different stores without being able to reuse some of the knowledge they might have gained with other stores?
Okay, so are you saying that on the repository level, you can hide whether you're talking to a NoSQL database or a SQL database?
I wouldn't go that far. There is the primary benefit, I think, that layer adds is, first of all, convenience, no matter if you switch stores or not, because it just it eases your work. And the other part is that, let's say you've worked on a project that has used JPA for quite a while, and you get into a new project that uses MongoDB, right? Those are different data stores, and you will have to cater the different traits of those stores. But still, if you use Spring Data MongoDB, it fundamentally works the same way, right? You still have the repository interfaces, you still have those query methods that you can declare. That doesn't actually free you from knowing about how to write a proper and performant query for that particular store, but all the API or the application code facing bits sort of work the same. Just as in Spring Framework, there's templates for JDBC or JMS, the messaging Java messaging system. There's completely different technologies, of course, but just by the virtue of the fact that these templates sort of work the same, you sort of get some kind of knowledge transfer that's reasonable amongst the stores.
Yeah, because the API just has templates, for example, and they all feel the same because they are basically the same concept.
And that's actually different things. That's actually a good point to get into, what's underneath the repository, right? The repository is the most upper abstraction layer that we expose, and that's sort of can be technology agnostic. It doesn't have to be. We try to strike a balance there. However, there's also lower level APIs that we expose that still give you some benefit in terms of resource management, exception translation, all the things that Spring users expect usually from happening. Exception translation meaning that you'll get the store specific transactions translated into the Spring data access exception hierarchy so that your client code doesn't have to catch those store-specific exceptions, but rather can use the generic ones, really.
So what you're saying is that if I really need to use that very specific API function of that specific data store, I'm free to do so, and I can I'm not tied to working on the abstraction level of the repository if it doesn't suit me for a specific use case.
Right. The templates by purpose expose very store specific APIs. Right. So the idea of that abstraction is rather a more technical one, even to take care of the technical aspects, like I mentioned, but still give you the access to very store-specific things like, let's say, upserts in MongoDB or something, very specific database features that in the NoSQL space are usually features that you choose a particular store for. So you choose a Neo4j because you can do graph traversals. You choose MongoDB because it allows you to nest documents inside documents. And so you choose them because of their special traits, and if you want to use them, you can still do so behind these templates and can integrate them into the repository APIs very easily. So that's the point here.
I mean, if I look at some of the persistence frameworks that, in particular, customers are creating, they often try to aim for a generic abstraction that abstracts away the specific data store and tries to make it all look the same. Yep. So you're using a different approach. Can you say a few words about why you're doing that?
Yeah. I mean, the probably the most significant aspect here is that diversity in the NoSQL space. So I don't think it's like a remotely reasonable idea to try to get something like Redis, which is a key value store, to share some API, data access API, an API really, with Neo4j, for example, which is a graph database. Right. So we started the projects trying to do something similar, which was kind of trying to look at document stores, like the categories of NoSQL stores, as one. So try to sort of unify, let's say, MongoDB and Couchbase in the document area, or Redis and Gemfire in the key value space. But it very quickly turned out that even in that area, certain aspects, especially from the store specific features area, are very hard to unify, because if you want to use the indexing capabilities of MongoDB, you'd have to use the mechanism that MongoDB supports for that. And of course, you can create a generic at index annotation, but for example, to allow to define those indexes. But if they then sort of have to work the same way on MongoDB and Couchbase, that created a tension that we didn't want to actually, or that turned out to be not very useful in the end. So we rather thought we go with the store-specific APIs on the templates level, and then rather use that programming model kind of approach on a more abstract, in other words, the repository level.
Okay, so, I mean, at least a few years back, there was a discussion about how there are standards lacking in the NoSQL space.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? Is that actually true? I mean, should we wait for standards and they would solve all those problems?
That's a tricky question, because there actually is some effort to create a JSR for NoSQL. Right now, there's some folks working on it. And we are remotely involved with that. But I think it's going to be a hard thing to do, especially because the standards are usually API-based. And it's kind of... The challenges that I just described will basically pour into that work, right? So I'm looking forward to see what they're going to come up with. And I already shared my concerns, thoughts, opinions with them. And there's going to be something. That's it. But I don't think that it's really necessary, because, I mean, there is, of course, Spring Data. There's even a CDI, a Java EE-based CDI extension, which means an extension to the standard that does sort of similar things, at least for the JPA side of things, as we do. So there are options for developers these days, and...
Yeah, we should probably say that CDI is one of those standards that are part of the Java EE space.
Right, right.
And the JSR specification or standards that you just talked about are basically the process that Java EE uses to come up with standards. So the standard that you were talking about,
yep,
is standard in the Java EE space that would take care of NoSQL databases for Java developers only.
Right.
Okay, so you said that the project basically provides data access APIs for the different data sources. There are like all the different NoSQL flavors, relational databases. There is a repository concept where you would get a repository that gives you high-level access to the data store. And we talked about templates that allow you to work more easily with the proprietary APIs of the data stores. So those are the three parts of Spring Data that we've covered so far. Is there anything else that we are missing?
Yeah, one thing that's special to the NoSQL space usually is that we also implement or take care of the way you map your store-specific data structures onto Java objects. That's something that's covered in JPA already, because that's taken care of by the APIs, by the standard, or the persistence providers implementing the standard. But the drivers that we have for NoSQL databases usually expose like map-like structures in MongoDB or just like key-value based things in Redis. So there's still a need to actually map this data to Java objects case you're into object, not relational mapping, but object to store mapping. And there's some generic API that we expose, or an annotation based model that we expose, usually also more tied to the specific store. So you'll find Mongo-specific terminology in the mapping annotations for MongoDB, for example. There's been a lot of, like, of course, reflection involved. That's the way that the JPA providers usually do it as well. But we've very recently investigated like other approaches that make that more performant, because it's usually that part of the DataX or of our code that adds the most overhead to the entire interaction with the store. Because of course, if you like read 10,000 objects from the database, it's the most performance critical part. But there's been like a couple of very decent additions recently. So, yeah.
Okay, so that's where you're basically doing what for relational databases JPA does.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just talked about performance, so I mean, I thought that if I have a problem with the performance of my data storage, it's probably more about the database. Now, what you're saying is that object mapping might also be something that needs to be optimized. So...
I don't think it's a critical part, because like of course if you read a lot of data, then the interaction with the data store over the network is still the primary driver of what adds up to the latency.
Right.
It's just that in our code there's different parts basically that like creates the repository proxies or the template implementation. That's sort of an indirection between your application code and the driver code that we eventually use to execute. And the object mapping part is the most performance critical one. That's why we actually focus the most when it comes to performance optimizations on that stuff. So there is no doubt an overhead attached to it, because we have to like analyze your objects and use that. But that comes, of course, at the benefit of being able to just conveniently map your data onto the objects. And there's also escape hatches for that. So if you really find that the object mapping is introducing an unbearable amount of overhead, then you can like sneak into the code and provide your non-reflection based, non-generic code to actually take care of that, and then just like on a very point to point basis optimize on that.
But I mean, so assuming that I have a performance problem with my persistence,
mm-hmm.
Would you say that what would you try to optimize first? How you access the database or the object mapping? I mean, if I'm using your Spring Data stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably like you can't really answer that without like having profiled the detailed scenario. So there's two aspects to it. I definitely look into the query execution times in the data stores.
Right.
To maybe add the missing indexes or something that can make a huge difference. And once you've done that, and you're sure that basically the store interaction works decently, and then you find, okay, this scenario is very slow compared to another scenario, then you can look into those hooks to do stuff. But I probably think that you're looking at the store interaction and making sure that you've used all the means to optimize the queries and the store handling. I'd start there first, just like make sure you'd have the proper indexes in a relational database before you actually go ahead and
absolutely
look into
other things. Cool. So how's the project organized? What kinds of modules do you provide?
So there's like roughly two separate parts to it. One is the relational side of things that's currently only covered by the JPA module. There's of course a core module that most of the stores basically share, where we have a lot of the common infrastructure implemented. And then there's different modules per NoSQL store. We have Redis and Gemfire on the key value side of things. There is Solr and Elasticsearch modules for the search-based NoSQL stores, MongoDB and Couchbase for the document stores, and then there's Cassandra, Neo4j support, and we've just recently added a module for LDAP. Basically, it's just an extraction from this general Spring module that supports LDAP interactions. Not all of these stores store modules are maintained by the core Spring Data team. For example, the Elasticsearch and the Couchbase modules are community-based modules, which means that either someone from the store provider, in case of Couchbase, actually works on that module, or it's even the community at all. So the Elasticsearch module is completely community driven. So it's someone from the entire outside, not really affiliated with Pivotal or with Elasticsearch or what have you. Right, and then there's another module that we get to talk about later on in there that's taking care of the repository exposure via HTTP resources, Spring Data REST. So we'll probably get to that later.
Okay, cool. So you do your releases in a release train where mm-hmm. all of those modules are released at one specific point in time. Yeah. So how does that work? How do you do that?
So we have a kind of release schedule that we communicate to also, like, I mean, within the team, of course, but also to the community projects. We execute a release for all the different stores at the same point in time. So it's not that everyone does releases individually. Like, one reason for that is that it's just like would become we'd probably do releases like every 2 days if we like with the just given the amount of modules, right? And the other thing is internal compatibility. So we're a bit in a weird situation when it comes to versioning those modules, because semantic version doesn't really work for us.
What is semantic versioning?
Semantic versioning is basically the idea that you have like version, you have a very specific structure to your version tags, like something like 1.5.7, and the individual digits express certain compatibility guarantees to the one using the API, right? So if I just release a bug fix release, I just increase the last version number. If I ship new features, I'd increase the middle number. And if I introduce breaking changes to the APIs, I update the first digit. The problem in that regard is, what is a breaking change and to whom is it a breaking change, right? Because we usually try to not break user-facing APIs. And as that's usually the repository programming model, you can argue anything that doesn't like break that is not a breaking change. There is, however, all the different NoSQL stores that release their new drivers or new versions of the NoSQL stores in a schedule that we totally don't have no control over. So like let's say MongoDB does a new release in October and a new major release, and then there's in January there's Neo4j coming with a new major release, and we sit in the middle and sort of have to mitigate between the two. So we still use semantic versioning for these individual stores. So whenever there's a breaking, you need to upgrade your store, for example, for that particular module, we raise the major version number for that store module. We just like combine all of those into a release train that then by purpose doesn't have any number associated with it. We use names of computer scientists, basically, so that we have some leg room basically to communicate potentially breaking changes. That means for some user that's maybe using JPA, an upgrade in the release train can involve not changing application code at all. But at the same time, if a store module was involved that shipped a breaking change, you'd probably have to do some work to upgrade. And
everything would be compatible. That is part of
right.
that release.
That's the
train.
Other. That's the other aspect. That approach sort of allows us to also make changes to the core module, because we sort of control the other modules, and we can do refactorings to that, introduce a new API and what have you. So we have control that within a release train, all the modules work with each other. That was another very important driver for that release train approach.
Okay, cool. So. Is there a difference between community modules and the core modules in that regard? Because, I mean, so far you only said that that it's the software is developed by other people, like not people working for Pivotal, and that's really something that I probably don't really care about. But is there a difference concerning the release train or anything else?
We include some of the community modules into the release train. So the release train is not core modules only.
Right.
However, I mentioned that explicitly because it usually means, I mean, those guys are not paid working on that stuff. It usually means they develop a bit slower. it could be we're not involved at all in the development there. So there might be some or to some people it of course matters whether it's something they can come to us for support, for example, or not in the decision of whether they use a module or not. But other than that, there's no real difference actually.
Okay, so there isn't really a difference concerning the release train or anything else.
No, it's just cool. Some blend in. There's also community modules that are not included in the release train. That's probably worth mentioning. We usually like talk to people that are interested to join the release train for quite some time and that they work externally first, so that we just make sure they're not just like dumping code on us and then we basically have to ship a not moving project all the time. But it's not a strict separation basically here.
Okay, I see. So what are the experiences with the release train? Is it something that you would recommend to other projects?
Interestingly, within Pivotal and within the Spring Engineering organization, we've been the first ones to start such an effort, and other projects like the Spring Cloud project, for example, have started doing the same, basically for the same reasons. I don't necessarily think it's something that you, like, if you're writing application code, it's something that you should actually strive for, because of course it creates a lot of coupling, right, between the modules, like organizational coupling, I mean. Mm-hmm. We're in a special situation here because we need to sort of mitigate the ever-changing world of NoSQL drivers that we don't control at all, and then make some guarantees to all the downstream projects like Spring Boot or Spring Boot mostly these days. So we have to make compatibility guarantees to those, and that's where the release train helps, especially our downstream developers a lot. Right, so it's not really we don't really do that for them, but it helps them quite a lot, because like a Spring Boot generation, like the current 1.5, is using the latest Spring Data Ingles release train, and it's just that they can upgrade to a release train, potentially ship changes to their APIs that they need to implement, and it's like it makes it easier to communicate those changes to the downstream projects. That's basically it.
So it seems to me that this is really a solution to a problem where you have a very tight coupling to a lot of projects that you either depend on or other projects that depend on your project. Right. It seems to me that it's a solution for your very specific problem, and in your case it's probably not possible, but maybe the more wise decision would be to avoid that coupling anyway.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is that we work on Java projects that will be used inside the same JVM process as other Java libraries, and that means there's like the compatibility guarantees have to be much stronger ones than if you say like you work with different applications and like one works with Spring Framework 4 and one with Spring Framework 5 and they're just like completely separated, right? And that works fine. I think that should be the ideal that you strive for. However, if you have to interact with other jars or other frameworks within the same JVM, then this kind of additional compatibility effort has to be taken care of, I guess.
Right. We should probably just mention that on the JVM, if for some reason or another, it's not possible to have different versions of the same library in the JVM at the same time. Right. So that's why you can only have one specific version at any point in time. Otherwise, you get very interesting problems. Okay, so that's great. Now, I did an interview for a different podcast for SE Radio not too long ago with Jürgen Höller. He's one of the project leads of the Spring Core Framework. And there are some extensions to Spring Core for Reactive. Can you say a few words about Reactive, what that actually is?
Okay, So you mentioned the interview with Jürgen, where you spoke about him with the additions that we're going to ship with Spring Framework 5 coming in Q2 in of this year. The reactive story, or the idea of being able to build reactive applications with the Spring Framework, is something that has had a focus, a specific focus on that for the last year, or even longer already. So the idea is that you basically completely switch to a different kind of model of writing applications. In Java, the especially web applications are very thread driven. So multiple concurrent requests are bound to a concept of a thread in Java, and then that thread basically takes care of the entire execution. And that means that if at some point you're communicating with the database, like down the stack, you basically wait for the answer of that database, and that basically makes the thread having to wait. That consumes resources, and that sort of works. There's nothing wrong with it in the first place. It's just that you're not utilizing the resources that you have on that machine very, very
efficiently.
Very efficiently. That's what I was looking for. So there is this idea of like reactive programming, where you rather, instead of like apparently like describing what you're doing step by step, and basically sort of potentially blocking on every call to another Java object, you basically describe the processing of that request in some sort of pipeline, which means you just like write code without really executing it. That's probably a bit of a weird thing to wrap your head around in the first place, but Jürgen explains it very well in the other podcast. And you get to a different kind of execution model, where you sort of try to avoid having to wait for someone else at like crazy, basically. So you want to avoid waiting for someone else.
So basically sums up to, in the traditional model, an HTTP request comes in, a thread is assigned to that HTTP request. If it goes to the database, then that thread would be blocked, and eventually when the data store reacts, an HTTP response would be sent out based on what the data store says. While in the reactive model, I would just take the request, work on it, and then tell the database to do something. And as soon as the database comes back, then I would react to that, and I wouldn't block a thread. It's just that every time something happens, like an HTTP request comes in, data store does something. Every time something like that happens, some thread is assigned and works for that short period of time, unless it would be blocked, and then it just waits for the next event and doesn't really block. Right. So that's the idea. So what I found interesting concerning, and obviously from that description, there is an impact on the data store, because in the traditional model you can wait and block until the data store reacts, while you can't do that in the reactive model. So what's the Spring Data answer to that challenge?
I mean, the challenge is actually coming from the typical flow of an HTTP request, for example, through the application, right? In the Spring Framework, we've taken care of making the framework stack, the generic framework stack, and especially the web framework, working in that paradigm. So there's actually a completely rewritten version of the web framework that allows you to use the special API constructs that you use with reactive programming, and allows the framework to not get in the way in the first place, right? So there is some case, if you're using Spring MVC, there's usually a class where you write the code that basically is invoked per HTTP request, because the request matches some criteria, and then you do some kind of work on it, right? You invoke some service downstream, another component, application component, that eventually speaks to a database. So if you're able to get the reactive invocation to exactly that point, to the controller, then the question comes up: what do you do on the data side, right? If you started like issuing a blocking call to, let's say, a relational database, at that point, you've basically totally subverted the idea in the first place, because you don't need to do all the fancy reactive stuff up front if you then all of a sudden start blocking.
Right.
So the first thing we actually need to do is sort of get out of the way in some regards, which means that we were looking in how we can on an API level, on the repository programming model level, can actually make sure that you can use those reactive types, and we can get invoked inside that reactive processing pipeline,
right,
that I mentioned before. And then that, of course, doesn't really help if that's again backed by some blocking APIs. So we were looking into the NoSQL space, and we're looking for NoSQL database drivers that already expose that reactive programming model. And it turns out there's one for MongoDB, there's one for Cassandra. The Couchbase guys actually have a reactive driver already. So we took a spike on those, basically just for the reasons that there's reactive APIs downstream mm-hmm. available, and then basically reworked our repository and template internals to actually work with those reactive APIs so that we don't get in the way in between. And there have been, there is a prototype out there, not a prototype, a first, second release, a second milestone release already with reactive data access support for MongoDB and Cassandra already. So, that's what we've done so far and what we think probably going to extend for other data stores there too.
And so you said that you're providing repositories that support the reactive model.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any change concerning the way that I write my code? Is it still...
There is a change that's not Spring Data specific usually, but a change that you have to basically go through when you're interacting with reactive APIs, which is that, as you said before, you're basically reacting to the appearance of events, right? So you're never gonna hand around like a person, like if you have an abstraction, domain abstraction of a person through your code, but you hand around the idea or the notion of that a person could like an event for that person could arrive, right? Like whether we in the Spring Framework implementation Reactor, we distinguish between a something that emits a single person, like a mono of a person, or a flux, which is basically a stream of persons, which is something you can probably better relate to thinking of it as coming from the database, right? You're not going to get a list of persons back from the data store, but an event stream of persons. That's the fundamental mind shift that's to be made here, and that of course leaks into the repository abstractions, because you have to change your method signatures in that regard.
Okay, so you said that this is being supported from MongoDB and Cassandra. Mm-hmm. Both of them are NoSQL databases. So what about relational databases?
There's two aspects that make relational databases sort of a not too well fit for that kind of thing. One is a very technical one, which is that most of the standardized relational, not most, all of the standardized relational data access APIs that are available, which is JDBC, the low-level data access API, and the aforementioned JPA, they've been like invented when that kind of programming model wasn't even like thought of. So they're all blocking APIs effectively. So they return lists. There's no way to actually make them reactive, like just like adding some bits and pieces onto them. That's the one thing, so that the existing APIs do not really match that paradigm. And the other thing is that you usually we have to avoid the impression that you could just like switch from imperative to reactive by just like changing APIs.
Right.
It usually involves like architecting your system in a slightly different way, and also using different technologies that then in turn support this reactive space. So the relational database space is usually tightly associated with the notion of transactions, which means like creating a unit of work or something where you block resources, where you want to isolate things from another, and then execute a bit of code and then basically free the resource again. And that kind of blocking approach is something that sort of fundamentally subverts the idea of reactive, where you want to avoid to block resources.
Okay, so are you saying that transactions and reactive are mutually exclusive?
Well, you can sort of make them work, quote unquote, together. You can sort of try to get them as much out of the way as probably possible, but they're not really fitting the concept in this case.
Okay.
So you're rather into like more fine grained interactions with the data store. It's more of a pull model even than a push model. Like, give me those. Instead of saying give me the five customers, you're rather saying, okay, I'm subscribing to that event stream of the customers that match a certain criteria, and then you get notified by the store. So that's a different interaction model in the first place. And the other thing is that that for read only access, you can probably sort of do something about it, but it's not the nicest fit. We even internally, we're still not quite sure what to do about that, about like transactions in general with reactive. For the low-level data access space, there are some reactive drivers for some databases, because that's the next topic basically downstream. You have the database actually has to support support that way of working in the first place. Right,
so you're saying even though the JDBC standard doesn't support it, there are relational databases that would support non-blocking I/O?
Exactly. So there's like, for example, a reactive Postgres driver that we could theoretically start to build something on top of, but then we're basically back to database-specific integration of relational databases, and the entire like JPA space, for example, the object relational mapping area is then... Is not going to be an option for working with that anymore.
Okay, cool. Okay, so we've spoken quite a lot about the different data stores and the APIs that you provide, the repositories and so on. There is a different project that you mentioned, Spring Data REST, and that seems to be quite different. So can you describe Spring Data REST in a few sentences and what it does?
Right. So it's of course, a bit of the odd one out, basically, because it's not a database connecting store module, really. The story behind it is that we've seen that people started to build RESTful APIs with the Spring Framework. That's a very common pattern these days anyway. But they were using Spring Data and built REST APIs in a very like canonical way with repeating patterns, and we were kind of like starting to explore how much of those patterns could be like generically implemented in a dedicated Spring Data module. So basically, thinking of it as we know a lot of if you're like building your applications, you have your aggregate roots in that application, basically the entities that the repositories manage, and you have the repositories. So can we do something about all this information and sort of generically implement some HTTP resources on top of that? One of the reasons that played into that is that there's a bit of an overlap, or at least a connection between some patterns that you find in the REST world that are also described in a couple of very good books on the topic. Things like the collection resource item resource pattern, right? So you have a collection, a resource, an HTTP resource that exposes, let's say, a list of customers, and then you have the individual resources for the individual customers. And that sort of resembles to the notion of a repository being effectively a collection of entities, right? And the individual entities being accessible through that repository. So there is some match here, and that was kind of the starting stone, basically, for starting that particular module.
Okay, so as you said, exporting a repository as a REST resource seems like a great match, because at the end of the day, both are about CRUD operations. So what is there even to add? Why would I even write my own REST handler anymore? Because I can just have it created for me by Spring Data REST, right?
Right. Yeah, that's actually a good one, because it's a very common misconception really about the project. So the sentiment, if you just like think about Spring Data REST as I just described it, you probably get to the impression that it's basically we take the data store, we put that repository in between, and then we turn that into HTTP resources. So what we basically do is we expose the database to the web. There's a couple of things missing, though. The first and foremost thing is that inside your application, you have a lot more knowledge about the structure of your domain, the structure of your entities, and you have that expressed in code than that there is available in the database. So things like aggregate boundaries, that's probably something we could discuss even further, but the boundaries, the natural boundaries that your domain model has incorporated, usually match nicely onto the structure of the resources, the boundaries of the resources. So there's a lot of things that you have to teach your let's say, object to JSON mapper manually, that we can basically infer from the domain model you have there. So there's some raising of abstractions really in translating those abstractions into certain traits of your API that you otherwise have to do yourself.
Okay, so you're saying that REST resources more like an aggregate, and that's different from what I would have in the database, like it's not just one table. So can you explain that?
Yeah, right. So let's say you have an order that has line items, and you have the customer that placed the order, right? On a relational database level, there's no difference between the relationship between the order and the line item, because it's just a foreign key, right. And the order and the customer, because it's just a foreign key. If you're staying with a relational database at least. So if you just like went ahead and just like naively turn that into HTTP resources, you'd probably have a resource for the order, for the line items, yada, yada, yada. But on the domain level, you fundamentally usually like add an additional layer of abstraction sort of here, because the order usually includes the line items, and there's like a composition relationship between the order and the line items. So you actually form an aggregate around those two, and then the link to the customer actually becomes a relation to the relation, not in the database sense, but just generically speaking, to the customer becomes a relation to the to another aggregate. Right. And that's something that's, by using Spring Data and the repositories, that's something that's implicitly expressed in the code, and we can use that to actually shape the aggregates around that. And by that, and the fundamental idea here is that for an aggregate, there are certain consistency rules that are most easily expressed if you can actually use the same shape if you turn that aggregate into a resource. So it's kind of there's a kind of nice overlap between the different concepts there. Which is why we actually make that the default in Spring Data REST. So we will inspect your aggregate boundaries and use those to basically create a defaulted representation of the aggregate for you.
And that's it, or is there anything else in this mapping between the REST resources and what the database provides?
There's an interesting other aspect that sort of basically is a consequence of us implementing those boundaries in the first place, which is like if we, let's say, if we take the order aggregate, right, and turn that into a resource, and then basically decide to include the line items but not to include the customer directly, like not embedded into the representation, the question comes up, how do you actually refer to the customer? And there's an interesting concept in REST there, which is the hypermedia aspect, which in its most simple form is just like linking to different resources, and we actually make heavy use of that in the representation creation for that. So you would get a link to the customer inside your representation of the order, so that a hypermedia aware client could actually go ahead and then like just follow the link to access the customer. There's a bit more smarts and details to that, but on a high level, that's all stuff that we sort of infer from your domain model, which you wouldn't actually get if you just like naively exposed your database.
Okay, so what would your expectation be? So let's assume that I'm creating some kind of REST service. Would you assume that I would write all the REST handling using Spring Data REST? Or is there something left where I would really do low-level HTTP REST handling all by myself, not using that library?
That's an interesting question, because I would have phrased it exactly the other way around. The thing is here is that you can get away with Spring Data REST only, right? So you just like have your entities, you have your repositories, mm-hmm. you turn on Spring Data REST, you get a slight raise of abstraction here because we inspect the aggregates and have you could be done with that. And actually that is a sort of turnkey solution. The thing is that you're still on a very low level in terms of like added benefit in terms of like business interactions with the service, right? You still need the client to know a lot of things about the internals, the structures, the semantics of the individual fields and what have you. You usually add more benefit through a REST API if you implement like more high level things in your REST in that API. For example, indicating when an order is ready to be paid, right? So if you want to like assume a client that has that go to checkout cart thing or something, go to checkout button in a mobile app, for example. So those things are not yet, let's say, those informations, when can I actually execute that call, is not really communicated if you stick to that level of abstraction. So the idea we actually have and the idea of the project is that we sort of give you those low-level things that will be part of your API basically for free or without a lot of boilerplate to give you more time to think about those high-level interactions with the service and then seamlessly integrate them with the parts that we provide out of the box so that you as a team can really focus on like the business process aspects of your API and add them to the stuff you get out of the box so that you're basically freed to not write the low-level stuff like the repetitive collection resource, item resource things, but rather can selectively implement the high-level parts of your application, of your API, basically, through Spring MVC then, Spring Data REST extensions, what have you.
Okay, so what you're saying in a way is that a Spring a REST resource such as an order might not just be a piece of data, but actually might be a business process and might give some idea about the state of the business process, which is actually something that might not even be in the database or might not be obvious if you look at the data from the database.
Right. There's like okay. just like the question. Okay, when am I in which situation am I allowed to cancel an order? In which situation do I have to pay the order? Right, and that's stuff that's not. I mean, that's sort of embedded in the data. But if you make the client just inspect the data to find out about that fact, you've basically replicated the business rule into the client. And by using hypermedia, you can sort of keep that logic on the client so that the client just looks for a particular link, let's say, in the representation to find out about the fact whether it can do or cannot do something. So
links, so you could have the business process and links would actually say which transitions are possible from
exactly,
a specific state.
Exactly. And okay. that's a kind of raising the abstraction level quite a bit more. It provides more benefit to the clients. It requires the clients to implement a bit more of like protocol complexity, as I call it, which means they have to be able to find links to interact with them.
Right.
But it allows you to keep the clients more free of like business complexity because it doesn't have to know about that. If in that field there's a particular value, then I'm allowed to do something. If I have to bake that into the client, I won't be able to change it freely on the server.
Right. It's not. It's. It doesn't need to inter. The client doesn't need to interpret the data. Basically.
Right. It can. It can get away with less knowledge about the business, which is a good thing because you can then change the business more easily. Right. That's it.
Okay. Excellent. So I mean. So you're obviously doing an open source project, and I assume that basically all open source projects are looking for some kind of help. So how can you help develop with these kinds of open source projects that you're working on?
So as I mentioned, most our projects live on GitHub. We're not all our bug trackers live on GitHub. Like the Spring Data projects, in particular, usually using Jira for a variety of reasons. But that essentially means that, like, you can just, like, register there. You can have an account there, which means you can file bugs. So whenever you use some of that stuff and you find something that's inconvenient, that doesn't work for you, please file a bug. That could be a typo fix in the documentation. That could be, like, something that's really broken. If you have a test case or something, please report that stuff, because we usually find it's actually our one of the... or the most direct ways you can get in touch with us, because there's no, if you just find something and don't report a ticket for that, there's like we don't have another way to find out, really, unless someone else does so. But right. I speak to a lot of people that rather find something but never take the time to the 5 minutes to create a ticket. So if you do that, that's very, very helpful.
Excellent. So, but I guess some people are just afraid that they didn't really understand something, and that what they consider a bug is really just a problem in their understanding. So, what do you suggest for those people?
I mean, we use Stack Overflow for general questions, so I'd probably propose to just start with that. But I mean, what could possibly go wrong? In the worst case, you just, like, file the ticket. We found out you're using it wrong, quote unquote, and then that's not less work for us rather than having to fix something. So, don't hesitate to even file the bug if you just, like, think you found something. If we, like, just all get, or if you're not offensive or anything, then you won't get an offensive response for that. So this, we really, really want people to interact with us. With us to file tickets and help moving things forward with that.
Okay, so what you're saying is it's fine to be stupid.
Well, of course.
But it's more important, and it's very important to speak up and to make people aware of the problems.
Yeah.
So what I found interesting is, so I always think that, you know, open source projects are really looking for developers. And, you know, the first thing that you said when it was about helping you is about bug reports and, you know, getting the stories from the users. So what about developers? Are you looking for developers, or is that not such a big concern?
Especially with the move to GitHub, I mentioned that for the Spring Framework before, but it's certainly true for the Spring Data as well. We've started to receive a lot more, like, direct contributions that are usually associated to a bug that someone found, because it's just so very easy to do on GitHub.
Right.
And we're of course always happy if someone, like, contributes something. In some cases, it might be worth just, like, issuing the bug report first, because, as you said, you might oversee something, or you might not be aware of some of the reasons something is implemented in a particular way. But before you actually start, like, spending time on hacking something together, because it might in the end be a waste of time. But generally speaking, just whatever feels right for you, right? Reporting the bug first. If you think there's a good contribution you can make, go ahead and just do so. So we're totally not restricted to anyone inside Pivotal or something with that. So,
okay, cool. Thanks. Anything I forgot to ask you, or anything you want to mention?
I don't think so. It's been pretty broad coverage. It's good.
Okay. Yeah, so thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for taking the time and answering all my questions. And have fun with Spring Data and the project.
Thank you for having me, Albert.
Thanks.